seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello, welcome along. It's US Open week. We're underway and we're very excited. There is much to discuss. We have Nathan Murphy as ever here in studio. Hello, Nathan.
How are you?
And someone who's good at golf is in studio as well. Peter Lawrie, hello.
Bit harsh. Hello. Bit harsh is right.
used to be good at US Open. We're recording this. I mean, it's kind of tricky, and I guess ideally you do it on a Wednesday, as one or two of you pointed out on Twitter. So we're recording around 2:30 on a Thursday Irish time, at which stage the featured group on Sky Sports, I've been watching them for about the last hour, Phil Mickelson, Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy are off to a fairly torrid start. We won't dog you with updates across the hour because we'll try and do something here which will be listenable to across today and tomorrow, regardless of score. So we'll speak in broad terms, but off to a tough start. It looks like a hell of a challenge already based on the early scoring today.
It certainly does, you know, going back to that golf course, it's a really, really difficult golf course. They've widened the fairways, but with conditions that are there today, it seems to be virtually, let's say very difficult. You know, best score at the moment is, I know we said we wouldn't do it, but one under after, you know, six holes is good going.
Yeah, very good going. So we'll come to the lads and the early signs from their ends in a moment. But tweets firstly. So Danny Finnan says that he will personally spit shine Justin Rose's spaceship-sized watch if he does the business for me this week after getting him at a really good price.
I saw that tweet. Yeah. He must have got some sort of a special offer somewhere. He got Justin Rose at 40-1.
Oh, well, Danny has
Justin
set
Rose
up,
is 14-1.
Danny has set up a new betting account or something.
Yeah.
Gareth Hughes said, holiday reading is sorted. Thanks, lads, at Golf Weekly OTB. He has the Tiger book. And Johnny Longhole in NYC, a regular listener, is looking forward to this week's major pod. Rose and Day, my picks this week, guys. And he's got his tickets for the final day.
Nice.
At Shinnecock. He's a New York man. Daniel Bennett is on a J1 and heading to Shinnecock. What a cultured thing to do on your J1. It's impressive.
It's the way forward, isn't it?
He's going on Sunday for the final round of the US Open. John Rahm is the man this week, Lance. Frequent listener and friend of the pod.
Oh, well. You could listen every week and still be frequent, I guess.
Woodsy, holiday book has just arrived. Your recommendations could make or break my holiday. #friend of the pod. He has ordered Slaying the Tiger and Tiger Woods.
We should. You think, have we made an actual impact on the amount of Tiger Woods books sold?
I feel we
because,
have.
Because, so, I think it was a Colin Burns book. He got a good, nice little sales bump the time he was in.
Did he?
And Shane Ryan, probably not quite as well known.
We put
Shane would have been
Ryan's
very happy here.
College.
Whereas Tiger's book is a big deal either way, but maybe in Ireland they sold an extra 500 copies.
I'm starting to think in that vicinity.
I've spoken about this book more than any other book I've read recently. Everyone I meet who's into sport, I'm like, you have got to read this.
The author is on the show next week. Recorded half the interview with him this
really?
Week. He had to run. He was going to Shinnecock. Typical. And so
what sort of welcome does he get at Shinnecock?
Do part two. Yeah, I wonder.
Oh, hey, Tiger.
Yeah. Did you read the book, Tiger Woods book?
Not yet, no.
Any interest?
Yes.
Really?
Holiday book.
Really, okay.
A couple of weeks' time.
Like, if they were to spend 4 years going back through Peter Lawrie's life and talk to everybody you've ever met, your first girlfriend, your first ever coach, like, is it going to be an interesting
a good book.
Read?
Yes, it would be, actually, yes. Mm. Yeah.
Did you pay your first coach? Or did he just look at you and think, wow, this guy's got the talent, I'm going to piggyback on that, I don't need any money.
No, certainly didn't do that, no. I had Brendan McDade from pretty much when I started till pretty much when I finished. So we worked out both of us did well out of it.
Good. It's interesting that you say you would be curious, because I think a lot of sports people have no interest in reading the books of any of their colleagues. I know Tiger wasn't an immediate colleague maybe, but you've probably heard more about Tiger gossiping around the table than this book can tell you, no?
Possibly so, yeah. So you'd love to know, you know, what is being said and then what you know to be true.
Give us your five best bits of gossip on Tiger Woods.
No.
So anyway, lots of people are buying the book. Mark Dunn is lying in the sun in Marbella, enjoying the first day of peace after getting married on Thursday, and he's enjoying the latest Golf Weekly pod.
Well done, Mark.
That's nice, isn't it? It was a nice picture as well, it looked like. I mean, I guess you go somewhere nice on your honeymoon, don't you? But It looked very nice in Marbella.
I met a lot of, we had a roadshow last Thursday night at Vicar Street. I met a lot of friends of the pod.
Good. They're out there.
And you just, you know, there was, I don't know how many hundreds of people were there. A lot of off the ball fans. All lovely people, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Friends of the pod. Yeah. You, like, you'd spend a bit of time with them and have a chat.
They're higher class.
And they all
people.
Want to talk about the Tiger Book.
Yeah, they're
They've all read the Tiger Book.
When are we having another Friends of the Pod outing?
Oh, I don't know.
Because now we've gone big time and are, you know, on the TV and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
YouTube. It all has to go through official channels.
Does it?
Can't do these sort of backhanded deals anymore.
Okay.
Unless, of course, clubs want to get in touch and, you know, they just want the
I have one in
particular. Private individuals to turn up.
Yeah.
We are here, I should say, as well, with thanks to...
Those guys are great.
The greatest Open, not the US Open, not the Open Open.
Well, this is a warm-up for...
The Irish Open. Dubai Duty Free. It's coming in a month?
A month?
Less than a month, yeah.
Is it 28th this month?
Nope.
No, it's the 8th of July.
8th of July. Yeah. 8th of July, 8th of July.
4 weeks.
Great.
I've got us accommodation, Joe. You'll be glad to hear.
I'm glad. I'm relieved. Anthony Grenin took a picture on what looks to me like Dollymount, where Christy Sr. would have practiced for many an hour. New golf course in Dublin City. Plenty of sand, though. Hashtag friend of the pod. And he's trying to...
You're actually not allowed to get shots on that beach.
There. Are you not?
No.
Well, Anthony Grenin did.
I was thrown off that beach many a times.
Really?
Yeah. I used to go out to Paddy Skerritt in St. Anne's, and he used to bring me out to the beach to hit balls and...
Wow.
Weren't allowed.
What length of iron were you hitting?
Oh, you could hit anything. But yeah. I was hitting like 3 irons and 4 irons.
But you can't be doing that on the beach.
Well, you try and hit a wedge off a beach and you'll know all about it.
But I presume you would just go to a beach, maybe just with your sand wedge to...
Oh, no.
Why not?
No, because... Ask Philip Walton. He used to play practice off the beach all the time. And it's the way forward.
Really?
Yeah, Vijay Singh the same.
Because you pick the ball, don't you? You get it very cleanly.
Correct.
If you get it anyway fat, you're obviously
screwed. Hit it nowhere,
Yeah, interesting. Because Christy O'Connor Sr. picked the ball. There was no divot, really.
No, very different.
And that was a consequence of Dollymount.
Well, there's a difference between picking it and compressing it.
Yeah.
You know, he compressed it. So, but there wasn't much of a divot.
Okay. We've got a Christy Sr. special on the way, actually, in the next couple of weeks. Brian Hegarty said... And do you know what? I'm kind of here with him a little bit. I read the book. I listened to the book review on the podcast. He's an asshole, and I still want him to win. Why?
I still want him to win. Mm. And maybe it's not quite the story of redemption when you read how much of an asshole he can be during his life, but like you only have to watch back the video of the 2008 US Open. Watch him winning that in one leg.
I watched it this morning, actually, the official video with Rocco.
It gets better with age.
Yeah, it does.
You just want that, because there is nothing quite like it. There is nothing like that momentum of the world's greatest.
Did he not overplay it, though?
No, I think if anything, he underplayed it.
No, he overplayed
it. I think absolutely he underplayed it. I think an awful lot of people would still think, yeah, they say a broken leg. But no, it was like he twisted his ankle.
That's what Peter Lorre thinks.
No, it was overplayed.
Peter thinks it was dramatic.
He was full of painkillers, stuff like that, and whatever may else.
But he still had a broken leg.
Yeah, well... Are we sure it was a broken leg?
It was a fracture.
It was a fracture.
Well, are we sure of anything?
Well, hold on a
second.
And
his ligament was gone.
Hold on a second. Let's bring in a few, hurlers or GAA players. And
they're not playing a game with a broken leg.
Well, they could be playing with a broken hand. Bernard Dunn, recently I spoke to him. He boxed with a broken wrist.
Mm. LeBron played 3 games of the NBA with a broken hand.
Yeah, but...
No.
I'm sort of with Nathan, though. I mean, the amount of pressure he's probably putting through his knee for a golf swing is huge, no?
Absolutely, yeah.
You just think it was kind of Mickey Mouse leg break?
No, I don't think it was Mickey Mouse leg break. I think you're right. You know, there was either a fracture there or a break there, but he was full on whatever painkillers that the pain was not getting to his head or his brain.
But so you thought him like... On the tee box after he's hit a shot, as Rocco goes walking up the fairway and he's got one hand on his driver and he's bent over at the waist and he's holding his knee, you think that's just to put an extra zero on his next
endorsement?
Absolutely.
Seve Ballesteros to his best, you know?
I love the cynicism.
Yes.
And he's convinced me.
There you go. Thank you.
Ian Kane, this is absolutely the way forward for the game of golf ... hashtag friend of the pod. Ian is talking about the Shot Clock Masters at the weekend. So the stats here, average round in 2017, 4 hours and 44 minutes. Average round in 2018, 4 hours and 14 minutes. An exact saving on average of half an hour per round. And the interesting thing is that the average stroke per round was one shot better playing at the faster pace. Admittedly, the weather seems to have been better in Austria in 2018 versus 2017, but it just shows it hasn't destroyed scoring somehow. The really interesting takeaway for me watching this was how rarely they even flirted with going close to zero on the shot clock. Like, it just showed when they were ready to play and had done their business before with the caddy and everything and were ready to pull the trigger when it was their turn. They had loads of time. 30 seconds was beyond enough time. Most of them were hitting their shot before the clock hit 18, 17 seconds. That was kind of the really interesting thing for me. And
but it still took them 4 hours and 11 minutes. So they saved half an hour. Yeah. So it probably does burst any sort of myth that might be there of, oh, we can get to 3.5 hour rounds. Like, it's never...
And this was on a short golf course too.
It's never going to happen.
You know, like, Austria's not a long golf course in any shape or form.
Okay.
But they had 37 referees. Now,
the whole new industry.
That can't, like, you have to pay 37 people for a €1 million tournament.
Yeah. Is there any way for one person or even a handful to monitor it from television base?
Well, you could literally do it on a each person is monitored.
Yeah.
You know, sort of CCTV. Like
pay a bunch of kids in out of college.
No, but I'm sure there's a device there that, you know, when it's your shot that you have to play it or whatever. I don't know.
You could just have the rule that, well, look, we've got five referees who are sitting in a bunker and the shot clock is going and everyone, and if they see you go over, you might get away with it here or there, but if they see you're getting pinged and you're getting pinged with the shot penalty or whatever the suitable penalty is, that would put enough of a fear of God into them to keep them moving, no? If it was enforced, you know, you'd need it to happen within a tournament or two.
I just think the referees, they had the ability there to enforce their, to enforce the timing of each person. But if that was there on every tournament, that, you know, in the background, if you go over, you're immediately... a shot penalty rather than a fine or a warning or whatever.
It has to be a shot penalty.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So it's a shot penalty, that's it. So the clock doesn't really need to be there as long as the threat is there.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
What if we go 6 months without it ever happening, even if guys are taking too long over shots?
Is that not the reason the shot clock is there? Yeah. For that exact reason, that actually there are rules in place that should prevent slow play. I do think, I don't think they having five in a bunker would work, because there are slight exceptions that if you need a ruling or that actually suddenly you're into, well, is it the 10 minutes it takes somebody to come out and actually make the ruling? Does that then change? Suddenly the round's 4.5 hours anyways. What was the point of the entire thing? I was just imagining when you said five referees in a bunker, an actual golfing bunker. Like, are they going to be like lurking somewhere?
Very sandy.
Uncomfortable after a little while.
While having a chat.
There must be a way though, because I must say, even watching Sky Sports this afternoon, the featured group of Mickelson, Spieth and McIlroy, what was just unbelievably apparent is the gap between shots. Like, they were waiting for the lads ahead to finish at one point. McIlroy was in the rough, and honestly, it felt like 5 minutes, 6 minutes. I was sitting there watching it thinking, oh my God, this is actually dreadful how slow this is.
Yeah, but the only thing about that is, so I'm all in favour of a shot clock and trying to speed up these tournaments. I don't think you can do it at majors. So the difficulty, I would imagine, at Shinnecock, if your ball is in the rough, or you're thinking about these unbelievably fast greens with the pressure, you need to be able to take a little bit of time to think it through. Like, there's probably, I don't know, maybe I'm totally wrong, but I would think at a US Open venue, there's probably five, six options for every shot.
Yeah, I don't mind that so much. Look, at a major, we're all going to watch it. Only saddos like me at 1 in the afternoon are going to watch the featured group, which is just going to be slow regardless. It's just three players playing around a golf. And, you know, a major on a Sunday, there's enough going on, or Saturday, people will watch the majors. But to make the regular events more appetizing, we have to speed them up. People don't care enough about the Austria Open to sit through 6 hours.
Not at all. No, but are we looking at it in the wrong way? You know, are we looking at it, should we be looking at it as in making golf courses more playable, that you can actually play them quicker? You know, are the greens too fast? You know, do the greens need to be that fast?
Like, Greece often mentions that. Yeah.
If we go back in time and look at the whatever 1980s, you know, how slow were the greens in comparison to where they are now? And there's a massive difference.
Yeah.
So you have a 10-footer. You know, you just couldn't hit it 2 feet past because you couldn't hit it hard enough. But now you have a 10-footer, you know, and we watched it there on TV, you can hit it 10 feet past.
Mm. Yeah, Jeremy Cleese often mentions that.
So that's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is, you know, do we take out of the likes of these green reading books? Do we take them out? Do we take out, you know, you can't use or bring in the fact that you could use a laser? You know, will that make things quicker? So there's lots of different ways to try things rather than, you know, just give guy 40 seconds to hit a shot.
Okay. Well, it's something we'll come back to. It's kind of an ongoing topic anyway, isn't it? Brian Mahan then had an amazing day at Kinloch in New Zealand, rated number 4 in the country. # friend of the pod. Anyone here played in New Zealand?
No.
Yes.
Yeah?
Never played Kinloch, though.
Good golf courses there?
Superb golf courses there, yeah. Yeah, absolutely superb.
Not to reopen the topic we've just left, so we'll scoot on by it quickly enough, but Kevin Kelly said, Joe's idea is gathering steam. And then he had retweeted Eddie Pepperell, who says he's coming to the conclusion that bogeys are probably the best answer to slow play. Me and Eddie.
Me, you and Eddie.
You know?
Eddie's is searching for his green tick.
I saw that, yeah. His blue tick.
Blue tick, is it blue tick?
Yeah, blue.
Yeah.
Come on, Peter. Give it the program.
Okay.
Pro V1 Kenobi, you can't beat a summer's evening. Golf course to myself, listening to at Golf Weekly OTB. Yeah, it's very nice. I played Lutterstown the other evening on my own. It was deserted.
I did it the week before.
Did you? There is nothing better this time of the year.
Great how we'd never text each other and say, by the way, I'm just kidding. Sorry, I could text. Nah, I'd much prefer to go by myself.
You were at work. I was half listening to you on the
you
Saturday.
You were at work the Saturday. It was a Tuesday evening.
Actually, you weren't. Tommy Martin was in. Where were you? I figured you were busy then. Yeah.
I was camping, Joe.
Well, that's your problem. Brian Hegarty had his 14-year-old reading the Tiger book on Kindle and then him the old-fashioned way with a book, obviously, in France on holiday.
Well, I don't even know if I'd let a 14-year-old read Tiger's book.
No.
Yeah, there's a few bits. Yeah. Then 14, like, yeah. If they have a smartphone, they've unleashed hell.
Probably doing worse than Tiger did.
I mean, no joke. We're not talking about your 14-year-old, specifically Brian Hegarty, I'm sure. He's fine. Derek Henry points out, read the negativity bias of the book. People who do have, see, we reviewed the book last weekend. People who actually have good stories, he says, about Tiger, probably like him and therefore didn't contribute out of respect to his privacy, which I thought was an excellent point. If you get on with Tiger, if you have a relationship with Tiger, if you've seen the best sides of Tiger, then you're not going to contribute to a book that Tiger has not authorized and probably doesn't like because of all the stuff in it about his father and everybody else. So, like, it's notable. Nota Begay doesn't talk about his relationship with Tiger. Various others who probably have a good relationship don't contribute. That is probably the one weakness of the book.
Well, you can ask them that question when you conclude your
interview. I'm going to, yeah.
Because, so maybe, I don't know if Nota Begay is the best example because he's still, it seems, one of Tiger's best mates and has almost made an entire career off the back of being Tiger's best mate. But somebody like Mark O'Meara, where some of the most interesting stories are about Tiger's relationship with O'Meara and ultimately how they were so good to him, how he admired them so much, but that when it really came to moments that counted, Tiger wasn't there for him. Mm. Where did they get that from? So did people contribute and just said, I don't want my name used, you can have these stories, these things happened. Mm-hmm. Surely people would have come out. And I think maybe people didn't come out and be complimentary overly to Tiger during it, but there were a lot of times where people have said, oh, Tiger was fine during this and that they tried to even it out a little bit.
Mm. In places, yeah. Interestingly, I was just watching them do another interview in preparation for having them on, and it doesn't come across as strongly in the book, but when they were doing their interview, they certainly buy the new Tiger. They think it's they think it's legit. That wasn't as clear in the book. They think he's a changed person. He's been humiliated enough. Mm. He's come to realise that his 14 majors don't guarantee him happiness or love or affection from people, so he's been a nicer person. He wants a bit more out of life.
Those things are overrated.
I know.
14 majors.
Does that not always happen though when somebody reaches on their way to the peak of their career, they're an absolute you know what?
Yeah.
And they forget everybody who's on the ladder. And then when they fall off the ladder, I know you're like that, Joe. You know, you're TV3 and all the rest. But when he has fallen off the ladder, now he's searching for somebody to talk to, somebody to be with, because he's back to being ordinary.
Certainly plausible. Ties in with, I guess, basics of human nature.
Yeah. And it's happened to loads of other players as well.
Mm. Faldo. Is Faldo now a nicer person? Do we know now that he's not competing and winning? On TV, he's like non-stop jokey. They don't always hit the spot, admittedly, and his Graham McDowell joke at the Ryder Cup wasn't his best moment either. But is he a nicer, more affable, more likely to stop and talk to you person, or do you know?
I don't know, but I wouldn't have thought so.
Right, okay.
In my opinion, knowing the person that, knowing Nick for what he is.
Jesus.
So there you go. Whether he was at his peak and being a really, really, you know, really horrible person,
yeah,
to when he wasn't at his peak to being a really, really horrible person, has he changed? Does he, you know, he, it's like, I would put him in the same example as Colin Montgomery on a golf course is dreadful to play golf with, right? Off the golf course, he's one of the nicest people you'll ever meet.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely gentleman. But on the golf course, everybody's in his way, you're in his way, and et cetera, et cetera.
Would he be aware of that perception?
Yes, I would have said so, yeah.
Clearly can't seem to control it then. If he's a nice person off the course, you would think he would prefer to be a nice person on the golf course, but clearly doesn't happen for him.
No.
But how then do you approach Monty? Is that alter your perception of him completely? Because it's one thing, like, being this nice guy off course, you're not looking at him all the time thinking, complete asshole.
No, I'd, you know, at least he, you know where you stand. You know, on some of the other players out there, you just think, you know, wow, could you be, you know, this much of an asshole all your life?
Mm. Interesting. We'll move on. Let's talk US Open. So, Shinnecock then. Some of the stats, and have you ever ventured?
Never played it, no.
Up that way?
I played a US Open, but never played Shinnecock.
It's Jay Gatsby country. It's Long Island. It's very wealthy. It's the Hamptons. It's a beautiful part of the world. So the stats are that the fairways apparently are 15% wider. So on average, they're about 40 yards wide, which in comparison, it seems, with 04 when Retief Goosen won it, is incredibly generous in the eye. The rough certainly seems incredibly thick. Everybody's calling it a second shot golf course. And the other noteworthy thing at the moment is, even though there's more acreage to the greens, as a few people even showed in Sky last night, Rich Beam showed, still on the greens, because they're so slopey and so fast, the net area you can still land the ball is
quite small,
minuscule. So it's still unbelievably difficult to hold those greens. And a lot of them have big runoff areas, and, you know, there'll be lads having balls rolling back to their feet, as happened Jordan Spieth in his triple bogey on the second, which was the 11th hole, but his second, where he got out of a bunker. I watched it. It was like a routine bunker shot. He wasn't short-sighted. The whole green to work with. And look, you could see the pin was far end of the green, maybe five on. And, you know, he's got the whole green, rolls it up. It rolls just a touch by, ball stops. I kind of half looked away. And then I look back, I see him kind of jogging across the green in vain because the ball has rolled an extra few millimetres and then shoots down, well down. Mm. He chips back on, the ball comes back to his feet. It was that kind of a horror show. So, man, when it's baking hot and when it's windy and the greens are sloped like that, these guys are going to be absolutely wrecked on Sunday. The mental anguish and torture and concentration of this thing is quite something. So there's some of the overall facts on Shinnecock. Par 70, 7,400 yards. It's longer than it was in 04 when Retief Goosen won.
It already feels, from looking at the early scores, as though it's going to be interesting to see where we stand at the end of Thursday as the reaction of the players to how the course has been set up, because everything that we had seen this week suggested it would play, certainly regardless of the conditions, that because the fairways were so much wider, that it would play relatively easy and it would depend on what they did with the greens. But some of the scores we're seeing already, like Rory's six over now.
Ooh, through already, how many?
Through five holes.
Like, I see. Is that him out of the tournament at six over?
You can never say you're out of a tournament at a US Open, but definitely. Yeah, definitely. You know, today being the tough day, I would have said, with windy conditions, you can definitely play yourself completely out of it.
I presume at a US Open, it's harder than, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, I presume it's harder to chase at a US Open when scoring is difficult than when it's a birdie fest.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because at a birdie fest, the leaders tighten up a touch and you can just take the handbrake off. Whereas US Open, I mean, there's no birdies there.
No. You purposely, you stand in the middle of the fairway. I remember being in the Olympic Club and standing in the middle of the fairway and thinking, right, where do I hit my next shot so I can possibly make par?
What year did you play?
The Olympic Club, which was 2014, was it? 2013, 2012?
I'll double check.
2012, I think.
2012. Who won? Is that Webb Simpson's year?
That was, yeah, Harrington had a good chance to win it.
He did. 2012. We were at the Euros at the time, but I remember watching it on a dodgy feed, yeah.
Hit it one.
Yeah. Great moment.
So tell us, what was the nature? Like, was it single file fairway and thick rough? Was it a typical US Open?
It was a typical US Open, yeah. You couldn't miss it in the rough at all. And funny enough, I started off par, birdie, birdie, and I thought, wow.
Wow. You know,
top of the leaderboard. Here we go.
Wow, were you?
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, it came crashing down.
Are you looking? Do you have a picture somewhere of...
Yeah, yeah.
To what extent did it come crashing down? What happened?
I just kept on making bogeys, and I couldn't stop making bogeys.
Right. And are they bad bogeys, or are you kind of thinking,
no.
I couldn't have done much better there?
Yeah, you just kind of, you have a 12-footer for par on really fast greens, and you say to yourself, well, do I really try, for, you know, really have a go at this one, or do I roll it down? Hopefully it holds its line. But when you're hitting a putt so, you know, slowly, it doesn't hold its line, it wanders off.
And is the reason you might only have a 12-footer for par that you trickled into some rough, maybe off the tee, and therefore there's no getting to the green?
There's no getting to the green, or you're trying to hit it into an area that is, you know, the size of the table, and you might have missed that and it's rolled off and you've chipped it. Your best chip that you could possibly do is 12 feet or 10 feet.
Did you feel it was unfair? Did you think to yourself, this is bullshit?
In ways, I remember there was one par three there, you were kind of hitting 3 wood in, and if you missed it at all, you were dead. Mm. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a bit unfair, you know what I mean? You're hitting 3 wood into a green and you have to, you know, land it on a sixpence. So yeah, I think, you know, I think the USGA got it wrong in places, you know, historically.
Yeah.
You know, I would have said the last 2 years, I think, have been, you know, very Mickey Mouse golf courses.
Well, our last over par winner is Justin Rose at Merion.
Right.
Like, Kepka last year had 16 under and there was a bunch of guys on like 12.
Mm. Yeah.
So everybody's been in the red since 2013, and one suspects the USGA, as much as they maybe like have been burned by going too far in previous years, were thinking, we've got to get back to something approaching US Open. Like, the argument has been made this week that the US Open has lost its identity. What is it? That they've almost gone from, you know, the marketing around the thing, it's gone from the toughest test in golf to the ultimate test in golf. And people are saying, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. But I think that it's not based around the golf courses that they've picked. You know, Chambers Bay, and the other one before that was the one out on the peninsula, wasn't it?
Chambers Bay was out in the peninsula in place.
Chambers Bay. Sharon Hills?
Aaron Hills last year. Yeah. That was the first time.
And, you know, they were first time golf courses that nobody had seen before. They were set up, I think, incredibly well. They tried to set them up difficult, but they weren't actual difficult golf courses.
Well, the fairways in Aaron Hills last year were 60 yards wide.
Yeah.
Like, Brooks Koepka was looking around thinking,
what's going on here?
Some 16 under.
Yeah. So really, they've come back to Shinnecock, which is, you know, a really tough golf course. You know, they've held US Opens there. Mm. The golf course has been there since 18...
Well, it held the 18... second ever US Open in 1896.
Right.
And it's held it 3 times since. So you had Raymond Floyd, Corey Pavin in 95 and Retief Goosen. So this is only the 5th time. But it was one of the 5 founding USGA courses. And it's generally been talked about as one of the best in the world.
Yeah. So it's nice that they go back to a golf course that people know, people heard of, and it's, you know, the reputation is there that, you know, you can set up a golf course that's quite difficult.
So those incredibly tough golf courses, that the traditional US Open courses, the way they set them up, say, as they did when you played at the Olympic Club or as they did at Merion, do you look at a week like that and think, yeah, this is an ultimate test of golf where the best player is going to win? Or do you look at it and go, there's actually quite a bit of luck involved in this, that 1 yard on the wrong hole off sees you roll down and impossible to get back. You've a double bogey, you've a triple bogey. You can throw holes away, that there is more luck involved in a course like that than there is in an easier course?
No, I would much prefer to play the really, really, really difficult golf course where you stand in the fairway and you make the odd, okay, I'm going to actually leave it short of this green because that's the best place to leave it for me to make a chip and a putt for par. Rather than if I go for it and it takes a bounce, as you said, you know what I mean? It goes off into some unplayable line and I can't get it up and down. So I think the harder the golf course, the more strategic golfer will do well on.
Just to remind you, okay, sorry to do this, but I mean, look, you've played at the US Open, so it's far more impressive than anybody listening. So you went even on your first hole, then 1 under, then 2 under, stayed at 2 under, and then you had 5 holes staying at 1 under. And so you were even at the turn, and then 4 over for the back 9, which was the front 9 on the course. But 4 over, did you kind of think, It's not.
I thought it wasn't too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then ultimately you go from 4 over to 11 over on day 2.
Yeah.
Now I'm looking at the 11 over. You get to +12 at one point on the 9th, and then you play.
Thanks for this, by the way.
No, I'm okay. Okay, but look, it's
absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
It's a car crash front nine on day 2, where you go from +4, bogey the first, then you have a double.
Yeah.
Hold it a double, then you have another bogey, then another bogey. Hold it, then another bogey, then another bogey, then another bogey, and you're 12 over on the 9th on day 2. Right?
Yeah.
And you play the back nine and 1 under.
Yeah, back nine was a bit easier.
Was it easier?
What was the cut?
Oh, I think the cut was maybe 6 over.
Right, so you're +11. Do you kind of walk off at +11 thinking, I didn't play so bad?
I didn't. Yeah, right. I actually didn't play that badly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was a very tough golf course. It was my first experience of a US Open. And, you know, you'd probably say to yourself, you know, if I could have done a few things differently or approached it, you know, thought-wise a bit differently.
Anything in particular?
Well, I played with Harrington in the practice rounds, right? And he couldn't hit it out of his way, but it didn't bother him. Even though with so many people watching you, because in the US Open on the practice days, it's just mobbed. Mm. And it didn't bother him in the slightest. And I was actually, I think the first 2 days, trying to play like I was, you know, playing in the tournament to a point, you know, because you have so many people watching you.
So was he doing something in practice when you say couldn't hit it out of his way? Was that because he was trying different things,
or
he was just not having a good day?
He was just not having a good day.
But he didn't care.
He didn't care.
Around.
No, he was just having a look at the golf course.
You felt a bit intimidated by the crowds, maybe?
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
I better be on best behavior here and hit the
ball
well.
And try. You know.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Were you wrecked after the 2 rounds?
Shattered.
Yeah.
Shattered.
That's what struck me watching today. Even the McIlroy, Mickelson, Spieth group. Man, they're trying so hard. Every shot is like.
Life and death.
I get stressed on a golf course over nothing, like, because it's like, oh, this is going to be, I'm going to have to 2-putt back and it's going to be double bogey. Oh, I got to land this club. It's like that the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Well, just because there's so many disasters out there, you know, and each shot that you play could cause you to make double bogey or triple bogey, and it could be just one bad shot.
Mm. Well, that's having seen some of the golf a little bit earlier and looking there. So, Rory just had a birdie, which I think after 6 holes, the first birdie McIlroy, Spieth, Mickelson have had.
Right.
But on the previous hole, he drove into that really bad rough. So the stuff that they like to show you on the Monday when the journals are out there going, oh, if you just drop the ball here. And he had the exact shot of a video I watched earlier in the week where you take your full swing, hit it as hard as you can, it goes 6 yards and it's still in the same stuff. So that was a double bogey. So again, that's one shot that it's probably what hopefully will make it interesting at least. On the Sunday, when the pressure is on, that there's always that risk that you can have the sort of calamity that we like to see from time to time.
Mm. Yeah.
But, I don't know. The winds are meant to straighten as the day goes on. So, like, maybe level par leads after the opening round, and maybe you get in a 5 over, you're happy enough.
I see Justin Rose is even through 7. That looks, you know, it's a big name going along okay, but like Day's +3 and Phil's +3, Spieth +5, McIlroy +6. Ugh, that's
You'd
ugly.
Love to see Mickelson do it, though, wouldn't you? Like, it would be a Jack Nicklaus story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be one of the, if not the, be one of the greatest stories ever. Yeah. Like, to complete the Grand Slam.
Yeah.
Runner-up 5 times in the US Open.
Would it not, something not be taken away, though, if he was wearing the shirt? As he is today?
It'd be unfortunate, yeah. He'd have to just go normal for the Sunday, for posterity. So, I mean, just to touch on some of the contenders here in no great depth, like, McIlroy's been playing this course since 2013. He first started playing it with Bill Clinton because that's his life now. Yeah. So, you know, he missed a really bad putt early on. I haven't seen all his play, obviously. He was saying, like, the course sets up lovely for him. He was going to go out and play conservative. He's about 57th in strokes game putting this season. Like, where do you think his game is at generally? Were you expecting him to do well this week?
Rory is kind of this enigma, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know, you can never say Rory's going to win this week. He just doesn't seem to be able to, you know, produce it when you think he's going to produce it.
Someone asked me this morning if there's like a lack of killer instinct. And I didn't know how to answer. I thought that's kind of becoming a legitimate question. But then again, he's won so much. But. Yeah. Oh, it's 4 years. Like,
but he's closed out so many tournaments,
yeah.
You know, with a killer instinct.
Yeah. Can you lose it, do you think?
I don't think you lose it. I think I think he's just had a lot of negativity in his head, let's put it that way. You know, he's seen a lot of bad shots and a lot of bad things happen to him. Mm. And, you know, they're hard to get over. And also, there's so many other good players out there now that, you know, you can be made look very ordinary very quickly.
Do you think Rory has lost the belief that was certainly there up to maybe 18 months, 2 years ago, that if he plays to his best, he wins the tournament?
Yes. Look, I'll say it again, and this is no disrespect to anybody out there. If I had a horse that was running in Leopard Sound this evening, right, would I ask you to ride it?
Yes.
No, I wouldn't.
Oh.
I'd ask a jockey. I'd ask a professional jockey to ride it. But thanks for that.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's if I wanted it to win, that's what I'd do. And now that's no disrespect to Harry Diamond in any shape or form, but I just think you need somebody on the bag who has the ability to say, "Look, mate, cop yourself on." You know, I'll go back and I could tell you many stories when Dermot Byrne was on my back, and many a time he had to have a chat with me.
Rory doesn't want that, though.
I know he doesn't want that, but either does the horse want somebody to whip him into to win. Mm-hmm. And
unfortunately, though, here the horse is your boss, and the horse is going to decide.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay, I'll give you another example. Adam Scott
and Steve Williams looked totally.
Right. Yeah. When did he play his best? Steve Williams ran the show there and Adam Scott produced the goods. Mm-hmm. You know,
Rory never had that relationship with JP, to be fair. And his barren stretch, if we're going to call it that, did not start with Harry Diamond. It has predated Harry Diamond. He never had it with JP.
That's what I mean. He's never had somebody on the bag that is strict enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, okay. That's a very interesting point. You wonder now if he... In his own mind, he used to always feel, it seemed, if he played his best, he was the best player in the world. And everybody sort of said that. Mm. That's a big psychological shift to have to deal with if you're him and you're looking at, is it DJ he might be scared of? Is it a few of them?
Well, I would look at DJ and I would think, you know, McGinley made a great point. I was listening to him last night and about DJ being he doesn't think about it too much.
Uncomplicated was the word.
Yeah, uncomplicated. And to be honest with you, you know, it would be nice if Rory could get back like that, you know, uncomplicated, not really thinking too much about anything other than, you know, hitting the ball up the fairway onto the green and hold the putt, you know.
I watched, a very quick point. I watched his congressional win back, you know, the US Open videos are on. Look, lots of things strike you about it. I mean, he's so free flowing and it was, he just feel like a carefree kid, even though he just had the Masters meltdown, I know, a month beforehand. But the other striking thing was his putting routine. Not his stroke, not anything about that, but just his routine was so much quicker. He was getting over the ball, he was having a look, he was bumping it with his little tightlist blade putter, old school style. There's so much more thought going on now when he's on the greens. You can see, like, it was just, I hadn't seen the congressional thing in a long time, and it was suddenly like, whoa, I don't remember him being this quick on the greens in a long time. One look, bump, gone. And like a lovely, smooth, flowing kind of thing.
Nearly 4 years since he last won a major?
It's four. I flew home from Brazil at the World Cup to see him win at Royal Liverpool. And then he obviously wins the WGC and wins the USPGA a month later. So it's a World Cup cycle. He's 28 now. Like, you remember when he was 24, we were thinking, oh my God.
10 majors.
He's going to win 10.
Yeah. Mm. So we've had 13, 14, 15 majors since then. And I would say at least five or six of those on the Tuesday, people said, soft rain, soft course. It's Rory's, and it didn't happen for him. He didn't go and win. And when McGinley was last on with us, he was answering the Rory question as usual, and he was saying, listen, I think Rory needs to think about these challenges in a different way. So Rory, it seems as though, still looks at courses and go, I can win this tournament by playing my golf on this course, rather than going, well, the course needs to be attacked in this way, and I'm going to alter my game, and I'm going to find a different way of conquering this course. And he's still not in that mindset, that it's still... I can go and I can overpower. I can
pose
play
my game on it almost. Yeah.
So again, you look at maybe the way he started this tournament, and you wonder, has he made the necessary changes for this course? Is it the other way? Is he overthinking it?
Maybe he's like he said. I know this course really well. Like, people were surprised that he had been playing this course for 5 years.
Like, I definitely do think, and I watched back the press conference yesterday as well. I'm at the stage because so many times I've been convinced by
Mickelson and Fowler and Tiger and Day.
Pre-tournament talk.
That. And Rory's brilliant at it. Like, there's a great honesty to an awful lot of things that he says, but pre-tournament he is feeling good.
Always,
and everything.
Yeah.
He loves the course, feels it sets like, up nicely.
But Harrington used to be totally different. Harrington used to say he was feeling dreadful and he had an injury and all the rest. He was playing crap and and all of a sudden he'd be, you know, right up there on the Sunday.
But I just, like, Andrew Cotter of the BBC followed Rory for 9 holes the day before yesterday, Tuesday, and said it was an exhibition. Not a single shot out of place. He dominated the course. He looked phenomenal. So, like, what's going on? Equate that for me. Like, I suspect Rory in practice is phenomenal most of the time. I would say if you played a practice round with him, you'd come away going, good God. He just shot 5 under in that 9 holes. Every shot was perfect. It was an exhibition. It was amazing. That's my suspicion.
Alex Noren said the exact same thing in Wentworth. After the it was the first or the second round.
Yeah.
He said that was absolutely flawless golf. I should give it up. And then he comes out and shoots a good score the next day, and Rory's,
Which is why, say, the killer instinct, to use a different word, let's get our thesaurus out, killer instinct, pressure, whatever you want to use, he's not operating as well under it, it seems.
What about desire?
He must desire a major. He's played 18 out of the last 19 days. He's played this course a lot. I presume he's practicing hard. I mean, he was within a bad putt on Masters Sunday on the second hole, potentially of winning there. Like, do you worry he's not working hard enough? Is that what you're dancing around?
No, I'm not. I'm just you were looking for a different word, and I was just saying maybe desire. You know, maybe, you know, when you have so much at your hand and you're playing with the likes of, you know, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, you're flying around in your private jets, you're whatever, staying in your yachts, stuff like that. You know, it. Does it become a stage where, you know, you lose a bit of desire?
Mm.
You know, it certainly hasn't affected the likes of Phil Mickelson, you know, who has it all. But I don't know. I'm only, you know, throwing out the idea.
Look, he could come back in easier conditions. He could pull back 2 shots today and easier conditions tomorrow. And we could be here sitting here on Friday night saying, do you know what? Never doubt the guy.
But I do feel we'll be having this conversation again at the Open and... It is because probably he talks such a good game, doesn't give us that little bit of extra insight. I think the pressure point is one of the more interesting because we just think of Rory being the coolest, calmest guy around. But actually, does he step up in the first tee now on a Thursday of a major and think,
the scar, 4 years? Scar tissue and 4 years.
Seven, eight, yeah. These things. Like,
he must start thinking I should be on 6 at least.
Even in interviews, and Harrington's going, you failed if you don't win 7 majors, mate.
Well, how cruel would it be, just say in a terrible world, Rory somehow never won another major. Then, like, it's the most unfulfilled 4-time major winning career, Hall of Fame career of all time. It's like, oh, Rory's the one that got away 4 majors. Isn't that extraordinary?
That can't happen. Like, golf.
Yeah. How many majors did Greg Norman win?
2 British Opens, was it?
Yeah.
Just two British Opens. Like, that's a weight.
So there's a career that, you know, that, okay, some of them were robbed away from him, you know, when he has
the chip in.
Well,
did Tiger bring that up during the week about Norman leading on the Saturday night of all 4 majors?
Yeah. He did. So there's another career that we can talk about.
Yeah, so it's not unfeasible. So I'll park Rory if there's nothing else for the time being, and we'll see how he goes. Just a quick word on your favourite player, Jordan Spieth, Peter.
Yes.
So he's struggling today quite badly. The latest I have is 5 over 3-5. He had that triple bogey in the second. I just checked last night. I was like, where is he actually in the putting? I was curious. Where exactly is he? Mm. He's 190th in strokes gained putting. I didn't even know they measured that far back. I've never had cause to check someone that far back before.
So, I told you, boys. I told you this a long time ago.
Well, hang on. But that, like, that's not right. Like, what? Like, he's so there's something. That's just an anomaly. Like, he can't be. He's not going to be 190th from being the best in the world for so many years. But it's I wonder now. Will he ever get it back?
I've been a naysayer to Jordan Spieth for quite some time. And you know, I watched him play, and you know, he was brilliant. You know, he's won his majors, he's putted unbelievably well, his game was very good, he believed in himself, but he definitely has lost the belief in his ability to get the ball in the hole. And no matter how you look at it, he has to get over that in some shape or form, and it's going to be very difficult.
I was kind of hoping that there would just be no logic behind it, really, Nathan, but like at the Masters, he finished third, 64 on the Sunday. I just kind of thought, well, just because it's a major week, he'll do something a bit magical.
The one thing we do know about Spieth, though, is that he's not going to end his career wondering, did I give it my all?
Yeah.
That if there's a way of working his way through this, he is the player who will find it. If there's hours that can be spent, if there's another way of relearning how to putt. Like, again, Tiger disappears for 18 months and reworks his swing. Maybe Jordan Spieth comes out in the year and goes, actually, I was kind of worried that my putting was going, so I realized I needed something drastic that would sustain me for the next 15, 20 years, so I decided to go through this now. I'm going to be very kind to him there. It's probably not that. He's probably just really struggling.
Is there a point, though, you'd say to him that he should take a bit of a break and actually stop thinking about it and stop practicing and, you know, as much, and then go back to it? You know, just take a complete break away from it, get his head clear, and then come back to
fresh.
You can't win with us, really, can you?
No, I think
some guys, they're not practicing enough. Other guys, maybe they just need to take a break.
I think putting more than any other stroke, though, is like that. The margins are so nuts that sometimes you're just like, ugh, you're just grinding so hard. You come, go away for a few weeks and you stand over it and you just start rolling a few in and you think, what was
in
all the
reality, fussing? You know, it is, it, you know, there's not a lot that can go wrong. It's it's more of a, you know, hand-eye coordination.
One last one to touch on, or throw in any other names you want to mention, is Tiger, obviously, staying in his 20 million dinghy. He keeps calling it a dinghy, and he thinks that's cute in the press conferences, but it's worth $20 million.
Yeah,
he put it up for sale for $23 million a few years ago and couldn't shift it, so he said, ah, I'll keep it.
Let's call it for $20 million. Surprised the missus didn't take half of it.
Well, he's 40.
That's why he didn't sell it.
He's 14 miles away from the course. Apparently the traffic is shocking.
Yeah.
A 3-hour job for people to get there, for the players.
Yeah.
That's a nightmare. Like, what do you do if your tee time is 9 and you'd like to be there an hour and a half before?
You're there for 6.
Are you going to have to give yourself an extra hour and a half?
Your worst tee time is probably, you know, that's probably your worst tee time.
Yeah,
you
I think
nine,
so.
9, 10 9, o'clock.
When the fans are all arriving.
Afternoon, you're probably okay.
So it's terrible. But anyway, Tiger doesn't have that issue, obviously.
But how's he getting from his boat to the golf course?
I'd say there's someone coming over in a little...
helicopter.
Little helicopter?
No, I was thinking a little dinghy. An actual dinghy. Oh, or right. Some kind of speedboat to get him there.
Oh,
I would think.
Real James Bond
style. You can go down a river from where
but I think he gets back to coast and then there's a nice...
You haven't thought this about...
No, so he...
thought this through at all, have you?
It's a James Bond thing.
Hops off the thing.
The thing?
The yacht.
The dinghy.
Into an actual dinghy.
Into an actual dinghy. Zooms across, sunglasses on.
Where? Zooms across what?
There's going to be some harbour somewhere. It's the Hamptons. And then he hops out where there's a car waiting and he's there in 2 minutes.
Oh, right.
That's my thesis. Based on nothing.
I'm going with the helicopter idea.
Fine. Whatever. Either way, he doesn't have a big commute. Tiger's the interesting one because actually, at different points, different aspects of his game have been amazing. So, like, he put it really well around the time he finished second at the Valspar. Remember the time he laid up in 18? It was weird, but he was putting well that time. And then at Memorial 2 weeks ago, he put it terribly, like genuinely terribly. But like Trip Eisenhower was saying, his iron play was like Tiger Woods back in the day kind of territory. So they say it's a second shot golf course, which brings his irons into play. Maybe he feels like he puts well. It's Poana grass, which he says he grew up on and he likes. Do you give him any chance here, or is it just, you know, look?
What about his misses into the heavy stuff?
Yeah. I guess that's a concern. Is 4,000, I know you haven't seen it and you don't know how much bounce there is in the ground. Is 7,400 too long for him to unleash the stinger and be competitive, do you think?
No, not at all.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, then maybe he just leaves the driver in the bag a bit more.
Yeah.
Leaves his ego back in the dinghy.
I know, it's hard.
He wouldn't be calling it the dinghy if he was leaving his ego at home.
Randall Chamblee did an interesting piece of analysis on his driving, because sometimes it's very good. And he said he noticed that when there's no danger there visually, he drives it dead straight every time. I guess everyone can relate to this a bit, but he said if there's danger on the left specifically,
he'll hit it way right.
He gets quick and he's afraid of the double cross. I don't know, he's afraid of something. So it's like a psychological thing. But his technique when he's got no danger is completely different to his technique when there is danger. Isn't that interesting that Tiger Woods is still suffering with that kind of nonsense?
Yeah, I just don't believe he has a shot. I don't believe he has a stock shot. He's literally standing on the tee and what do I do here? do I fade it or do I draw it? You know, in Monty of his old, you know, used to be able to stand up on every tee box and hit this lovely big juicy fade.
Could he ever hit a draw, Monty, if you
no,
would say?
No. Okay. He can now, but then he couldn't.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jack Nicklaus says if you're going to play with a fade, you have to learn how to hit a draw first. But Monty might prove that that's not true.
Correct. Well, he won 8 majors without being able to draw the ball.
No, he didn't, though.
Oh, sorry, not 8 majors. Ace, order of merits, yeah.
Didn't win any majors.
Oh, on his eyes, he's won a few.
Oh, he's a multiple major winner.
It's hard to see. Like, before the Masters, sat here and thought, you never know with Tiger. I just think for a US Open is the one
too penal
tournament that you can't be going trying to find something and just hoping that this is the week with the putter.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I don't see Tiger in the top five, do you?
No.
Okay. Anyone else? Who's your tip? Dustin Johnson, our tip?
I'm back, Jason Day.
Okay, it's not going well for you.
Well, he's 3 off the lead, 4 off the lead.
Yeah, sorry, I need to refigure. Well, Matt Kuchar's now 2 under.
Oh, Cooch.
Cooch.
Cooch, it'll never last. It'll never last.
No, and deep down, Cooch knows that as well.
Why has he never won a major?
Too nice. Because he's not long enough. I think he puts himself under too much pressure with his second shot at times. He can't hit the ball out of his way, says me.
why hasn't he ever won a major?
Shane Lowry couldn't get over how short he was when he played with him, remember?
But Shane Lowry is very long.
I know, but he's played with other people who are
absolutely
medium range as well, and he doesn't slag them off. Like, he literally, like, Cooch can't hit the ball.
Well, I tell you one thing, I wouldn't mind his career.
That's what Shane Lowry said as well.
Or his bank balance.
What's your thing? Why hasn't Cooch won a big tournament then, a big major?
He just doesn't seem to be able to finish it off, like you said. You know, I don't think the length is the problem. He just hasn't finished a good, you know, tournament off. He's been up there, and then just falls away.
Yeah. Dustin Johnson then? The more I think about it, the more I think, why are we overthinking this?
Yeah,
he's not
overthinking
it. No. Yeah. Get up, no. Bang like, it down. Yeah. Go actually, in the rough. Yeah, I've got the best short game out there.
And he won last week, and he some players don't, you know, back-to-back is tricky. He won 2 in a row in 2017, 3 in a row in 16. Yeah. It doesn't mentally drain him the way it seems to other players.
No.
He hold out from Eagle doesn't and strut it off. Yeah. So, like, Dustin.
Dustin, yes. You know, I did fancy Jason Day. I'll take that one back. Definitely not your mate Jordan Spieth. Outside chance, what about Martin Kaymer? Played quite well last week.
Yeah.
Coming to a golf course where, you know, he is a decent driver of the ball.
I'll tell you why in a word.
Okay.
Chipping. Those runoff greens. Martin Kaymer's chipping.
He can put it.
Pinehurst, he can put it. No. I've been looking at some of these. I've seen the first hour. At Pinehurst, you could put it. You can't put on these. You can't put up these hills.
I would have thought you would have gone for your old mate, Francesco.
No. Can't put. And I won't go back to my listeners with Tony Finau. You know, I've won them too much money for that one. So, Martin Kaymer, outside bet, top 10.
Webb Simpson, 50-1.
Look, you can trust. I understand, listeners, if you want to trust Peter Lowry more than me, but Martin Kaymer, I would not go near with his chipping game on these greens. The runoff is too, it's too severe.
Okay. Mister, I know everything about golf.
I'm not saying I know everything.
We're all about our opinions in
absolutely.
Here, Peter.
Is it not a legitimate point to make that he actually can't, like, I watched Jordan Spieth going off and back on again. You could not put up the slope.
What Joel's saying, is that not a fault in your game that is heightened more than ever at a US Open?
Of course it is, yeah.
So what's he going to do when he rolls down 15, 20 feet off the backstop and has to chip up?
I'll give you how many golfers who've been out there that couldn't chip the ball and who did exceptionally well.
Go on.
Right now, off the top of my head, give me one of them, please, quickly. Quickly, give me one of them. I can't think of any.
All right.
Well, there is.
No, go big on Martin Kaymer. Put the house on him.
No.
Couldn't think of
definitely anyone. Not put the house on him.
You couldn't think of one chipper who was poor, who did well in golf.
Guilford. What's his first name?
Well, that
David Guilford.
David Guilford.
From 1987.
David Guilford could not chip the ball and still played a Ryder Cup.
David Guilford.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Are you like trying to win the argument for me?
Absolutely.
Oh my God. One last quick point. You got to go, I'd say. Are you under big pressure? Got to go.
Yeah. He's got to go.
You got to go?
Yeah.
Do you want to go now?
No, go on.
Backstopping. Did you see this during the week?
No.
Okay, in short, Jimmy Walker. Someone tweets at your boy Finau, plugged in a bunker.
Yeah.
And backstop is there. Oh, sorry, there's a ball.
Oh, now I know what you're talking about. Backstopping.
He hits a ball.
Yeah.
And someone just happened to tweet, you know, worst case of backstopping in some time.
Well, that's not where it started.
Oh, really? It was
Ben Ann and another player, okay. Michael Clayton, the journalist.
That's right.
Put up a video, but then the Finau one came up as well.
Yeah, okay. So Walker tweets in response to, he gets involved, different people are tweeting about it. Michael Clayton used to play in the Australian, he's Australian, used to play in the European Tour for 20 years. But so Walker said about the practice, usually a guy will ask if he would like to mark it. And Walker, by opening his big gob here, started all the controversy. He says, if you don't like a guy, you'll mark it anyway. He says, if you like the guy, you might leave it there to help on a shot. Some guys don't want to give help at all and they rush to mark their ball, to each their own. And so people are saying, what? You know that's against the rules. And he said, I tried to help everyone, especially if they get a bad break or got short-sighted. So your man Michael Clayton quotes rule 22.1 to him saying, in stroke play, the committee determines that competitors have agreed not to lift a ball that might assist any competitor, then they're disqualified. So Jimmy Walker gets a bit snide with Clayton. Doesn't realise Clayton's played on the European Tour at this stage. Really? Glad we have rules guys like you around. Do you have the call-in hotline number? What is it? Golf is hard, dude. Why don't you try it out? Clayton replies, I did try it. I played European and Australian Tour for 20 years. I know it's hard.
was Mike Clayton the guy who did that putt and he fell on the ball? Which Clayton was that?
Don't know.
Did you ever YouTube that one?
No.
Okay.
He's an architect as well now, it seems. General disdain, it seemed, for Walker's opinion. And Lee Westwood got involved then, saying the ball should be marked. A player has responsibility to the rest of the field. Walker challenged Westwood, saying, so you have never asked a player if he would like your ball marked. I find that hard to believe. And Westwood said, no, never. He said, my opinion is that you have a responsibility to the field. So it's not that big a deal, but it's blown up. Is it rife, the practice of backstopping? Would you have been dismayed if your playing partner had gone up and marked his ball when you were in a bunker or you were...
Not at all. No, I would like him to do it, to be honest with you.
And were you a guy who'd mark it?
I would always ask, is that okay? You know what I mean? Is it in your line of sight or whatever else?
Yeah.
And if they said, no, it's grand, then you'd leave it there. But, you know, you'd always be... Mm. Especially if it was inside a certain range. You know, if it was right next to the hole and you knew that... You know, it could help them. You know, you really should mark it.
And what's the general practice, do you think?
General practice is to mark it.
Doesn't seem like it on the PGA Tour.
A cultural divide then? I think the issue arose because with the first two players, there was a sense that they were friends.
Yeah.
So that there was a, oh, wait, the two lads are kind of
chummy,
helping each other out here.
Walker comes in and says, I do it if I like the guy.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's a very strange... thing to do, to leave your ball there, to help a fellow competitor.
Mm.
It's never totally seen that. Against the spirit of things. Mike Clayton sucks at golf. Oh no. Oh,
oh
no.
Yes. Oh yes. No. You've never seen that before?
I have actually. I didn't know it was him. Do a quick YouTube of Michael Clayton sucks at golf if you're listening and we'll move on. Yeah. Horrendous.
Exactly.
Any strong opinions on this other than, do you see it as cheating? That far? Cheating's a big word.
See, cheating's a big word. Depending on, look, you could go out, you're playing a nice friendly three ball, right, where you know the guys, and your ball comes up close to the hole. Do you say you'd leave it there for him because he's your mate and you're having dinner with him?
He's plugged in a bunker and he's a bit short-sighted.
Yeah. No, really, no. I would mark it. So my thing is, you know, you play by the rules no matter who you're playing with, and the rules state that you should mark it.
So how prevalent do we think this is?
I'd say it's quite.
Right.
Yeah.
Seems to be.
It's something I never actually
gave much thought to.
Not at all.
No.
And I'd question some of the people who have added to that there too, because they're not the most...
The only person I mentioned was Lee Westwood.
Right. I'll say no more. you brought him up.
I feel like we should all go out for dinner and a few drinks.
Oh, absolutely.
And have a chat a bit and stuff.
Yeah, and then the book would come out.
Okay. Well, it's going on and it seems it all blew up this week and some people are very upset. Can I ask you then an interesting question?
Go ahead.
At what distance from the green do you feel I need to go up there and mark my ball?
Oh, literally just around the green.
So you're not going to do it from 50 yards?
Not a chance, no.
Okay, no. Good. So just if you're properly all on the kind of green
territory. Correct, yeah.
Okay. Anything else anyone wants to mention or add? The latest, not that it's very exciting, is that Phil is still at 3 over. Day's 4 over now. He's lost another shot. McIlroy has pulled a shot back to 5 over. Yeah. You know, he's, that means the shoulders haven't slumped just yet. He's hanging on.
Well, yeah.
Makes a birdie.
Instinct is starting to kick in.
Desire.
Desire. Yeah, yeah. Ian Poulter is our leader on 2 under with Matt Kuchar.
I had a dream about Ian Poulter last night.
Did you?
Should have taken that as
a sign.
A sign.
Well, he's in reasonable form, isn't he? Mm-hmm. He's 1 under.
Is that why you wore that shirt today?
Oh.
This shirt got to do with Ian Poulter.
Well, he was.
I don't know if you've noticed, but it's a summer's day out there.
He was quite flashy.
Wow.
I wouldn't call that shirt flashy. Call it a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's great banter.
Top bants.
Right, we're done. So enjoy the US Open and we will review next week. Final word, who's going to win? Go.
Dustin Johnson.
Justin Rose.
Webb Simpson. Starter kid right here.